The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Think back to the last time you gave or received a bouquet of flowers. You likely took note of the colors and shapes of the blooms, took a big sniff, and then put them on display to enjoy. But did you ever stop to consider the clandestine message that might be hidden in that bouquet? For 19th century ladies and gentlemen of means, bouquets contained a wealth of secret information. Floriography was a symbol-based code used in the early 19th century to convey messages not meant for public consumption. Our guest describes floriography as the pre-digital version of emoji. Romy Stott is a filmmaker and writer, and she wrote about the secret language of flowers for Atlas Obscura. She's joining us now from Italy via Skype. Romy, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
What's the origin story of floriography, using flowers as a kind of coded messaging system?
Well, it was a big fad for kind of a long time, but it started out in, I guess it would be the 1700s. There was a feminist poet, Lady Mary Wortley Montagu. I've only ever read her name, so I'm not confident of that pronunciation. But she was the wife of the English ambassador to Turkey back in the early 1700s. And since she was kind of a popular writer, she'd send back letters that would get circulated kind of among the Whigs and popular society and feminists, talking about different things that she'd seen in Turkey. And so she'd write about things like, oh, they vaccinate for smallpox, we should all do that, this is the fashion everybody's wearing, and it was really popular. And she wrote about a code that she called selam, which I believe means hello in Turkish. And she said that it was a secret flower code that women in harems used in order to be able to get secret messages through kind of under the noses of the guards. She was probably wrong. Other people who knew more about Turkey at the time said, absolutely not. Like, first of all, there's just no chance that you could pass secret messages back and forth in a harem like that. But also that she probably was confused about a rhyming game that they played where you would write poems and the structure of the poem had to do with rhyming with the names of flowers, which somebody would have told her about because she was a poet. And it's a little bit unsure whether she was confused or whether she just kind of made it up as a romantic idea, because she was somebody who was very, very interested in how women could get power and could get political power in a patriarchal society.
So it sounds like the elites back at home really ate this up.
They did. People would kind of make their own codes and pass them back and forth kind of in secret notes. But then people would copy other people's secret notes. And some of the meanings would be kind of obvious ones that were like, you know, obviously a narcissus is going to mean something like arrogance or vanity because of the Greek myth. And there are some things where, for instance, the walnut people used to mean smart because it looks kind of like a brain. But some of it was obviously just kind of inside jokes or personal associations. The thing about a secret code is it has to be a certain amount secret or it doesn't work. But you also have to have enough people know what it is or it doesn't mean anything except to you. So it actually got to the point where you started to have dictionaries coming out of France and magazines like Harper's and The Atlantic. I was looking around, and between 1827 and 1923, there were at least 98 different flower dictionaries in circulation just in the U.S.
Wow. So some of the other things you mentioned in your article, hydrangea means you're heartless. Well, delphinium means you're haughty, and basil means I hate you. I was wondering, looking at this, how people back then, 18th, 19th century, had access to such a wide array of flowers.
Well, in most cases, they didn't. So it's getting used more in art. It shows up in literature. where you'll have like a character in a book like Jane Eyre, for instance, will be looking out the window at the garden and talking about the flowers out there, and they'll have meanings to the reader who knows that, oh, she's worrying about money because of what flowers she's looking at. Or you'll have flowers show up in paintings, and then it'll show up in embroidery and things like that, or just people writing letters about it or putting it in the pattern of clothing. Because, yes, you didn't necessarily have access to these flowers. I mean, even carnations were actually fairly expensive at the time. They didn't become cheap until more recently. They used to be a pretty expensive flower.
And what do carnations mean?
It depends so much on the color. Carnations and roses probably have the most meanings, where it really starts going into different colors, just because it's so easy to grow different colors of them. And with carnations especially, they also take very well to dyeing. So you can dye them colors that you can't grow them. Like Oscar Wilde was very obsessed with the green carnation specifically because it was unnatural. And he said that he invented it, but probably a lot of different people thought to dye a carnation green, but he said that he invented it and that it had a very specific meaning, and he wouldn't say what that meaning was, but everybody knew what that meaning was because he's Oscar Wilde and that's how he behaved.
So this kind of combination of elitism, wealth, love of exoticism, and the knowing way that people could interpret flowers of a certain status, when did this fad die off?
Really, World War I is when it kind of ends, because people didn't have the money anymore, didn't have the time anymore. You know, when World War I starts, everybody's focus goes to war. And it's also, I mean, it's the end of a lot of romanticism in England, which was really very much a center for this love of flowers, even though it was also huge in the U.S. Also, kind of once you get into World War I, you're seeing a lot of urbanization. And you're also seeing just a shift in science and the focus of science. Part of the interest in gardening that was going on at the time just had to do with the fact that botany was an exciting science at the time. Being able to keep an ornamental garden or being a gentleman farmer seemed very aristocratic to the Victorians. So it was kind of like going to coding boot camp. It was the way that you could talk about Darwin and work through your ideas of natural selection and whether you believed in that and whether you believed in evolution. Gardening was really caught up in that conversation around science, and to some extent, it just fell out of fashion as the popular science kind of more moved into a physics, ballistic, mechanical area. As you see more industrialization, as you see more urbanization, it gets more exciting to show off that you have a car because now cars exist. There were different ways of being able to flaunt your wealth, and modernism really comes in, and kind of an obsession with things that were speedy and mechanical, and the physical body and the body as a weapon, and a lot of ideas that are not really gentle and floral.
Well, Romy, this really goes in the who knew category for me. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Romy Stott, she's a filmmaker and an author, and you can find a link to read her article for Atlas Obscura, How Flower-Obsessed Victorians Encoded Messages in Bouquets. There's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As we learned just before the break, flowers can speak volumes as symbols of love or grief or celebration, but they cannot tell you exactly where they came from, a question that's especially vexing when you're picking up a bouquet in the middle of the winter in New Hampshire, and exactly the question that NHPR's podcast Outside In tackled for the recent Mother's Day holiday. Here's host Sam Evans-Brown.
Think about Valentine's Day. Not the stuffed animals and chocolate and cards. Zero in on those flowers. Roses, probably red, probably a dozen of them. But here's a quandary that perhaps you haven't really thought about a lot. Valentine's Day is in February, right? Where the heck are roses coming from in the dead of winter?
But that's kind of part of the appeal of flowers on Valentine's Day. When it's all cold and gray, that pop of red will warm any heart. And it's like you're bringing a little bit of the outside in. See what I did there?
This is producer Molly Donahue, by the way.
Hi, Sam.
Hi.
So anyway, when you want to get roses in the dead of winter, or to be more specific, at 5 p.m. on Valentine's Day, where do you go?
All right, this guy's getting flowers too. It's got like a sports jacket, sports...
No, he's going for the lettuce.
The flower shop?
The supermarket. Producer Taylor Quimby and I went to the supermarket. I just noticed you had a couple different bouquets in your basket. What are you looking for?
Something pretty that I won't get yelled at for.
Oh man, like three people right at once, straight for the flowers.
So when did you pick up those bouquets? Did you scout them out this morning?
You better believe it. You better believe it.
Was there good selection?
It was pretty picked over by the time we got there.
A lot of last minute people coming in?
Yeah, a lot. You know, and they're kind of getting a little upset with me. They're like, oh, this is all you guys got? You know, people are stealing flowers from each other, so.
Stealing flowers from what do you mean? Like taking them out of each other's cart?
But just stop and think about this for a second. Those roses that you're squabbling over in the grocery store aisles, how did those even get there? Fresh-cut flowers are nature's most ephemeral phenomenon. Poets have written whole collections using blossoms as a metaphor for the briefness of life. Where on earth did these roses come from in the dead of winter?
The truth is that even those kind of sad-looking carnations in the supermarket might be better traveled than you are.
I don't know about that.
Well, settle down. I think even you might be surprised by this one.
This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. And today we're going to trace a path that a cut flower takes, step by step.
We're going to look inside the $31 billion American floral industry to show you what it takes to ensure that nature's shortest-lived product will arrive in the grocery store or florist's fridge and onto your kitchen table looking fresh as a daisy. And that means starting down south.
Really down south.
South America south.
But not Antarctica south.
No.
We're not going that far.
Not that far.
I am in the middle of the invernadero, as we call it. It's white plastic.
That's Carolina Loza Leon, an Ecuadorian producer who went to check out the rose industry for us. She's at one of the many rose farms that blanket the region around Quito, Ecuador.
There are rows and rows of just, well, they were planted in November. Roses, red kind, they said, was.
Today, roughly 80% of our imported flowers come from Ecuador and Colombia. But this wasn't always the case. Most flowers sold in the U.S. used to be grown in the U.S. New Jersey had a handle on the rose market until it became more economical to move to California, where real estate wasn't as valuable yet. Colorado, with high plateaus, warm days, and cool nights, was also a big producer. But in 1967, a graduate student in horticulture named David Cheever at Colorado State University asked a key question.
It was pretty basic. Where's the best place in the world to grow flowers?
And?
Roses happen to grow very well along the equator. They like warm days and cooler nights, and the stems get very long.
That's Amy Stewart, author of Flower Confidential and the woman we turned to for her expertise in the flower industry. It turns out places like Ecuador and Colombia, regions along the equator with high plains, cool nights, and, oh yeah, low labor costs, are the best places in the world to grow flowers. Another advantage to places like Colombia? Bogota is a convenient 3-hour flight from Miami, and we'll explain why that's important in a few minutes.
This feels pretty unnatural, doesn't it? It's almost like the global government's central planning committee mandated that this is where the flower growing district was going to be.
It's kind of ridiculous and a little colonial.
But business flocked down there. Colombia now exports more than $1 billion worth of flowers each year, and most of that comes to the U.S. Other South American countries like Ecuador, Guatemala, and Costa Rica followed suit, but Colombia still has the biggest share.
And this fundamentally changed the way we buy flowers here in the U.S. Before the 1970s, flowers weren't really sold in supermarkets. The business in Colombia was just so successful that all the blossoms coming into the country needed outlets other than florists. And thus, the supermarket bouquet was born.
which illustrates the point. Flowers don't just do really well in these regions, they also do really well for these regions, at least in terms of making money.
There's a guy zigzagging through a rose and throwing pesticides, fumigating. Is that the word in English?
Carolina is describing the scene at one of the greenhouses near Tabacundo, Ecuador. You've got some workers weeding while another sprays down the rose with some sort of chemical.
And he's all covered, but the rest are not covered. They're wearing long sleeves and gloves and hats because of the sun has come out.
Because flowers don't go through the same inspection process as produce entering the United States, the emphasis is on making sure there's nothing visually wrong with the product. No bugs, no fungus. So there's a lot of spraying of these flowers. And at least at this one greenhouse, not a lot of precautions for the workers. Carolina said about 10 minutes after being exposed to the spray, her arms started itching, and some of the workers laughed when they saw her scratching.
Apparently, they're pretty used to getting it all over them.
He's going row by row. It's spraying everywhere.
This seems like a good time to point out that this isn't an exposé on labor practices and pesticide use in the flower-growing industry. But from what we heard from Carolina, and from looking at what other reporters have found, it's fair to say it's a mixed bag. Workers are exposed to some nasty stuff, but it's also an industry that has bolstered the local economies of flower-growing regions. 90,000 people are directly employed by the Colombia flower industry alone.
That's Jose Iván Cholango Sanchez. He goes by Don Iván. He owns his own small flower farm in La Esperanza, northeast of Quito, Ecuador. He's explaining the timetable that goes into growing roses. Some will need to be cut in a few weeks, others in a month. This might seem like a hassle, but there's a reason flowers rule this area.
In this region, prices and demand for produce is much lower. Don Ivan says he'd need about 12 acres of land to make it worth farming potatoes.
Which is not much land.
Not by American farming standards. But if you just got a little plot of land in the Ecuadorian highlands, you can still make a living with just a couple greenhouses and growing batches of a few thousand roses at a time, selling them to flower-crazy Americans.
Don Ivan starts cutting around 7 a.m., and that can last about 2 hours. Then there's weeding and cutting off the buds so that the stalk grows straight. Cut flowers are then put into water to be hydrated and then packed off to the processor, where they'll be classified, cut down again, and stored in a cold room.
In Don Ivan's case, that processor is the Asociación de Productores Agrícola Pedro Moncayo. How was my accent, Sam?
You studied French, didn't you?
I did, yes. It's a co-op, formed as a way for smaller farms to group together and sell their flowers to wholesalers. It's an alternative for smaller farms, and this one formed in response to poor conditions on bigger farms in this particular area.
That's Isabel Ramirez, director of the association, talking about the cycle between the two major floral holidays, Valentine's Day and Mother's Day, two big booms for the flower industry that come just a couple of months apart.
And for small-scale growers trying to satisfy demands, it makes sense to have an association like this handling your sales for you. Someone like Don Ivan can still be in the greenhouse cutting by 7 a.m., while the office handles sales calls on Moscow time.
Isabel's explaining that when her sales team comes in early in the morning, they overlap for just a few hours with Russian buyers who are just about to head home for the day. Selling to folks in time zones in the U.S. is much easier. But all this adds up to a setup that really works for small growers.
Don Ivan says he gets about 33 cents per rose through the association.
So while a single rose might cost you a couple of bucks in the grocery store, most of that money isn't going to the growers themselves. It's going to the rest of that supply chain that gets that rose to you.
So a flower grower might only get 10 cents on the dollar. And every time it passes through another layer of wholesale, distributor, retailer, the price gets doubled or tripled again.
Which brings us to our next step in this daisy supply chain.
Yeah. Whether or not a flower is coming from an association or a big farm, flowers end up packed together and trundled off to a distributor, then stuffed onto a freighter plane or in the space left in the cargo holds of passenger planes. These are usually some of the last flights to leave at night to limit the amount of time they spend idling on the hot tarmac.
And this is actually a really wild part of this process. Nothing gets shipped by air these days.
Yeah, Alex Madrigal had this great line in this audio documentary, Containers, that he just did, noting that nothing ships by air these days except for fresh flowers and f-ups.
Which really says it all. After their luxurious airplane trip, flowers wind up, almost certainly, in beautiful, tropical Miami, USA. But, okay, we had to ask. After all that effort to keep the flowers chilled, why Miami?
Most of the flowers in the United States come through the Miami International Airport because they have a cold storage facility there that's ready to receive flowers and food. And it'll get inspected and go on a truck. So maybe by Wednesday or Thursday, it's on a truck driving across the country to wherever you live. And it might go at that point into a wholesale market or a distributor where it's once again going to be in some kind of cold storage for a day or two or longer.
Like Amy said, sometimes flowers go straight to distributors, but it's those wholesale markets that caught our interest.
Lucky for us, there's one right nearby, the Boston Flower Exchange.
Can you smell freesia?
Oh, wow.
God, that's a beautiful bunch.
This is basically the flowery version of a fish or meat market, complete with very local vendors hawking their wares. It's catered to people who really care about their arrangements looking good and want to see what they're getting before they buy it. Getting a bunch of wilty flowers off the internet does not work for high-end florists and many local vendors.
Oh, it smells so good in here.
Is that steam over there?
Yeah, for the orchids. Yep.
That, by the way, is Emily Herzig. She owns a floral design studio up in Littleton, New Hampshire, and she was nice enough to let us tag along with her.
Anyway, those are actual olive tree branches?
Branches from olive trees, yes.
So this is like what Home Depot wishes its orchid selection looked like.
Three.
Home Depot's got orchid envy.
Oh my God.
But before we get too far into this, we need to make one thing clear. One does not simply walk into the Boston Flower Exchange.
Oh, yeah. No.
This is the number approved, so it has to stop.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Okay. Sorry about
all right.
That.
All right. I'm super sorry, too, Tony. I didn't realize
okay.
I didn't talk to the right
but
people.
But you'll have to stop now.
Yeah. Okay.
It turns out the Boston Flower Exchange actually has some really tight security restrictions.
Not just recommendations. I had to call two separate public relations firms to get permission to record, but eventually they gave us the green light.
Right, we obtained our proper permission. That's Bob.
The morning Emily Herzig allowed us to piggyback onto her trip to the exchange, she was picking up the raw materials for her floral designs. Little fruit tree branches, funny little bunches of leaves, and yes, flowers.
I went up this way, you guys. It was like really crowded over there, and I'm dangerous with these carts.
All the while, burly guys in the background hefting entire magnolia tree branches, you know, lots of little pansies, miniature orchids.
And the smell.
Even for those of us, Sam, who can't smell freesias. But while Emily was piling up her double-decker cart at one of her vendors, we learned one of the core tenets of coming to a place like the Flower Exchange.
It's not the volume here, it's the quality.
That's Chris Goodman, one of Emily's suppliers down at the market. He started working summers in his family's flower shop in high school, and he's still here 25 years later.
And he has surprisingly global connections.
Guesstimate, you don't have to count them all.
10, 12, probably, quite a few.
Those are different countries he's counting up. I know earlier we explained that 80% of the flowers imported to the U.S. come from South America, but that last 20% are coming from all over the world.
Wait, Canada?
Yeah, a lot of stuff comes from Canada. Yeah.
Which, if we're being totally honest, is totally wild.
It is.
Question. Okay, so you've got to have relationships with people all over the globe. How do you do? Like, how do you find them?
Good question. They find us, actually.
Doesn't it sound like they're all in, like, the flower Illuminati?
Secretly controlling your holidays since the 1970s? Yeah, it kind of does. But so, while there are certain trade routes that are much more popular, we get most of our flowers from South America, Europe relies heavily on Africa, this is a global industry.
And it has to be, because when a person is getting married, they don't really care that Lily of the Valley is out of season. So their hardworking florist will haggle with their wholesaler and they'll track down some Lily of the Valley from Japan. for a price.
So does it ever kind of amaze you how much goes into this business?
Yeah, and I definitely like am amazed at how much floral product we consume as an industry. Like I definitely stop myself sometimes and just like look at my studio and from one day it'll be packed, like every corner of it will have buckets of flowers, and like literally the next day it's gone. And I do often just sit there like, where does it all go?
Where does it all go? Well, much of the industry isn't going through wholesale markets anymore.
Because most people aren't getting their flowers from the shop downtown anymore. They're either going to a supermarket or they're going to the biggest store on earth, the internet.
The internet.
When I was a boy, I thought flowers were magic. You know what? I still do. I'm Merlin Olsen, and I've seen the magic of flowers. Delight a wonderful dad. Make a special day perfect. The magic of flowers, a magic your FTD florist understands.
We're talking about FTD, Internet Flower Juggernauts.
To be fair, FTD has been around much longer than the internet. It was founded in 1910 as florist telegraph delivery. And it's not the only big flora business out there.
There's 1-800-Flowers, Teleflora, ProFlowers, every other flower-related play on words that you can imagine.
And most of these big companies work in a similar way. Let's say you live here in the NHPR studios in Concord.
I hope you don't.
I hope you don't, too. But if you do and you want to send flowers to your friend in Austin, Texas...
So in the FTD universe, you can go to your local florist and place an order with them. They transfer that order to a local florist in Austin through the FTD network. Bing, bang, boom.
Your florist gets a percentage, FTD gets a cut, and that local florist, thousands of miles away, gets a sale.
And that sort of transaction takes up a big part of the flower market. Teleflora claims to have 15,000 shops in its network alone.
After a boom in the market in the 1990s, the number of retail florist shops in the U.S. dropped. But the industry value has continued to grow dramatically.
Like, a lot. In 2015, the U.S. floral industry was worth $31 billion.
And at the end of this long and wild supply chain, from a greenhouse in Ecuador to an airport in Miami, to a wholesaler or a market, and then through a retailer to your doorstep.
Our favorite spring things.
That's still a lot of roses, even when they're going for a couple dollars a stem.
Okay, but here is my question. Why are roses so popular? Are they just everybody's flower?
I don't think so. I think it's more that roses are available and they're in demand. Amy was telling us that the best-selling flowers aren't necessarily the best love flowers. They're just the ones we're used to buying.
We've gotten used to this more technologically advanced way of growing things where if you want a rose in February, you get a rose in February, even though that's kind of an absurd idea.
So if Valentine's Day happened any other time of year, like summer?
We might be giving bunches of dahlias, not roses. Genetically modified roses at that, bred for size and color.
Okay, but if people want huge, colorful flowers, why not just get silk ones?
Sam, oh Sam, have you learned nothing?
We can all spot a fake, and I think it's not the point. Like, the point is not to have a colorful blob, but the point is to bring some of the outdoors inside, you know, to have something of nature, but also something that's kind of exotic.
So yeah, people will spend $50 or $100.
Oh, God.
You okay? For an arrangement that will last, you know, a week or two, looking beautiful. And that's worth it. That's the goal of the industry.
If all of this is getting too big, too industrial, if there are too many voices trying to explain this system to you, don't worry. Remember Emily, the floral designer from earlier? She's your other option.
Producer Logan Shannon and I visited Emily's studio in Littleton, New Hampshire, where she was gearing up for that other boon of the floral industry, wedding season.
Wedding season!
Woo! Beginning in May, they'll start doing more events, about 40 over the course of the summer, and that's on top of the normal Say It With Flowers stuff, like birthdays and special occasions.
Is it in the main ballroom or the presidential?
It's in the garden room, which is the small dining room.
Yeah.
It's like the function.
And here she's talking to Emma Brumenschenkel, her assistant and all-around right-hand woman.
What we'll do, let's talk about the first two weekends.
And for all of you who are uncomfortable with the whole flower supply chain thing, the other option is something Emma and Emily work with fairly often, local plants and flowers.
The American-grown flower movement is picking up steam, educating people about the potential profit in flower farms these days. And in Emily's case, she does try to work with more local flower growers, not only because it's popular, but there's a lot of practical reasons too.
There's a need for it, and it's environmentally better to be sourcing things from within the United States and cutting down on that carbon footprint of things being shipped over from all over the world.
And Amy Stewart made a good point about this too.
When you buy local flowers, you're not just supporting a local farmer growing flowers, you may well be supporting someone who's also growing your food and trying to find a way to make that, you know, financially viable for them.
This is all well and good. I think we can agree that we're all for farming opportunities and for reducing our carbon footprint, but there's a reason why New England isn't the nation's breadbasket, or whatever the nickname for the Midwest is.
Yeah, we're not exactly in a prime flower growing zone up here, which makes sourcing locally a little tricky.
That's actually been more so my challenge about sourcing locally, is being able to get enough quantity, you know. So it's really not unlikely for me to source flowers from various sources, the same type of flower.
So yeah, if you want to opt out of this wild and crazy industry, it means no more bouquets on Mother's Day and Valentine's Day.
Or at least fewer roses. You know, mix it up. Because there's a reason we pick up flowers from the supermarket or put in a rush order for a bouquet when you've forgotten your friend's birthday, and why silk flowers simply will not do. Like the FTD guy said, flowers are magic. Emily's assistant put it like this.
Yeah. With you walk in there and there's nothing, and then we walk out of there and it's like a completely
like a
different world. And it's,
yeah, I mean,
it's definitely so important.
So, Sam, here we are at the end, and I'm thinking you should have the last word.
Me?
Yeah, but, you know, I'd really love it if you said it with flowers.
Said what?
Come on, Sam. It's been a long and twisted road. The portrait of a man, you, learning about the origins of an industry worth billions.
Are you guys really going to make me do this? I haven't even seen the movie.
Come on. Yes, Sam, yes.
Fine. Rosebud.
And that story was produced by Molly Donahue and Sam Evans Brown. You can check out more episodes from NHPR's Outside In podcast at outsideinradio.org. Thank you so much for following us down the garden path today. Music in this episode came from Poddington Bear, Gumball, Krakatoa, and Delay. You can keep in touch with us on Facebook or at facebook.com/wordofmouthradio or on Twitter @wordofmouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll all be back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.